was tailings number one, where there was a big depression and basically had a settling pond there, an evaporation pond. And then we started thinking about, you know, how could we produce maybe some fuel up here for some of at least our garbage truck and the local trucks. And at that point, ethanol alcohol was really starting to be talked about in the in society as a possible fuel substitute, and discovered that Jerusalem artichokes were an excellent source of production of ethanol and alcohol. Either the stalk had the starch, the tuber. Some of you have probably eaten Jerusalem artichokes in salads and so forth, and they have a lot of the stalk has the sweetener, it's sweeter. The tuber has the starch, and either one can be used for making ethanol alcohol. And WSU was doing a project down in Prosser, Washington, on their research station with Jerusalem artichokes, because you can also produce sugar from Jerusalem artichokes, and it's the type of sugar that is acceptable to those with diabetes. So it was of interest, and you could actually produce more sugar per acre with Jerusalem artichokes than with sugar beets. But for some reason, Jerusalem artichokes have just never caught on in the world. But through the context of WSU, they were done with their project, and they had 800 pounds of Jerusalem artichokes. They said if we would send our truck down, they would load up and they would give us these Jerusalem artichoke roots. And so we got them, brought them up here, planted them in the tailings, and then we irrigated them with the effluent that came from the sewage system. It was a crude thing, but it really worked pretty well. I mean, we had 8 and 10 foot Jerusalem artichokes growing up there on the tailings. And then we discovered that one day the pumps went off, and the deer just invaded because they loved the sweetness of the stalks. If we were irrigating up there with the effluent, the deer left them alone. But we even tried to grow some other crops, like we grew some tomatoes up there. And, you know, we weren't going to feed them to anybody. We were just curious whether we could grow anything in the tailings. And we had, you know, wonderful plants and wonderful tomatoes. And there was a fellow here from the Weyerhaeuser Corporation as a guest, and he was the head of the lab there. And I talked to him and said, you know, can we send a couple of tomatoes home with you, and can you test them to see if the tomatoes contain any bacteria and so forth? That, I mean, we weren't planning again to serve them, but we were just curious whether it would pick up anything from the tailings or from the effluent and so forth. And so he said, yeah. He says, I can't officially do this, but I can do it on my own, and I can't officially give you a report, but I can send you a letter. And so several weeks later, he sent the letter, and he said, no, there is nothing in the tomatoes that would make them dangerous to consume for public consumption. But of course, again, we didn't use them for that. But it was just interesting that we did have things growing on the tailings, and we did partially solve the sewage system. But that's, again, just one of the many. And then actually a young fellow from Minneapolis gave us some money to buy a 25-gallon electric still, because we really had intended to use the artichokes then to make ethanol alcohol and then to have at least our garbage truck and maybe some local vehicles. We weren't going to use them for the bus in case they stalled on the way down or something. But that part of the project never didn't get completed, so we didn't get into the production of alcohol. But it was another one of the interesting things that happened up here that I think was of interest to a lot of people. Well, this morning, the one thing that I wanted to try to do was to maybe talk a little bit about partially just observations. And, you know, I've been away from Holden since 1983, basically, so that's a long time. But I have kept up a little bit, and certainly have kept up with some of the activity with visiting with people and emails and so forth. Every organization changes. I mean, no matter if it's Boeing or if it's the church or whatever it is, over a period of time, organizations change. And I think it's natural, and we can assume that Holden has also changed over time. And, you know, maybe some for the good and some for the bad. But, I mean, change is inevitable. And I think even we see this in our church, and we can probably compare Holden possibly and partially to a church organization. And many of you come from congregations that started out small and grew rapidly, and all of a sudden they have gymnasiums and they have, you know, various other activity centers, and they have, you know, more buildings, and, you know, pretty soon you wonder whether, again, it's the facility or it's the program. And going back to what I said the other day with the conflict between Gil Berg and Carol Hinderle was this conflict about facilities and infrastructure and then program. And during the years Carol was here, there was never any doubt that it was going to be the program that was most important. And but I think without a powerful leader like Carol, that there's a, and also just because facilities deteriorate and need upgrading and need improving and so forth, that it's really hard to not have an organization this size with this much infrastructure to almost, go in the other way. So I guess it would be Gil Berg wasn't responsible for it, but he sort of represented the facilities and the infrastructure. And I think that, just from my observation, and I'm not trying to be critical, it's just an observation and it may not be right, but oops, I don't want to play with the cord, I'll get scolded. But the facility is so important up here that it's almost impossible unless there's a real effort to have that balance for the facility, and in a sense then the workers dealing with the facility to sort of dominate the community. And Holden is to a great extent hospitality. I think that one of the things over the years that has been very important is that people coming up here basically year after year sometimes with families or individually and coming up here to feel a part of a community. And community is just not something that's readily available to us in society nowadays for whatever reason. I mean, even within the church. I mean, the churches are, I think, have gone sort of corporate. I think my observation is that Holden has gone sort of corporate. And again, that's not, I don't think it was intentional. I think it just sort of happened because of the size of the operation. And the corporate model is easier to access through self-help books than the hospitality model, I think. And so it's natural that for whatever reason that Holden would, sort of get into the corporate model of things. And I mentioned previously about my experience with wanting to say hello to the director but needing an appointment. I couldn't just go into his office and say hello. And the more offices you have, the more management layers you have, in a sense, the harder it is to maintain the hospitality of a site. And that's always been the problem up here, because especially in the wintertime, it was a very small community compared with the summer, and it was the same people basically here for many months. And so that it was hard for some people to come in during the winter months and then feel comfortable in the community, because they were the outside ones and those living here were, in a sense, the community. But that can happen in the summertime too. If the facility and the workers that are involved in the facility are so dominant, then they naturally have their own schedule. They're tired at the end of the day. They're not as likely to want to visit with guests or eat with guests, and so maybe the board at some point could assign a hospitality person, that's all they do up here, is make sure that hospitality is one of the main things that take place. Because for Holden to remain as a community, I think it needs not only the community spirit of being together, but also the hospitality where every person getting off of that bus is made to feel special. And that's a hard thing to do, you know, day after day after day. But I think it really needs to be done. I don't know how you deal with the corporate model. I think it's up to those who are operating a facility, whether it be a church or Holden Village or any other organization. But sometimes I think the corporate model is done out of fear, because if I'm the manager or if I'm the director, and I have 10 people working under me, then it's easier for me to put blame on somebody else rather than accept the responsibility and blame myself. And maybe that's part of why the corporate model is there, because it tends to isolate and insulate the responsibility of each person. There's always somebody else to blame. When Carol and I were here alone, there was nobody else. I mean, in fact, I don't think even people were too much aware of how the Holden operated at that time, because it just operated. They would come in, they would be part of the community, and they would feel as if everybody was one. They didn't see a division between, staff, between faculty or teaching staff, and, the paying guests. I think the other thing that happened in those early years, which, still exists, but may not to the same extent, is the gratitude of people coming here. In those early years, that was our lifeline. If people didn't come and pay their very minimal amount to be here, we didn't exist the next year, and we knew that. And if we couldn't get enough gifts, if we couldn't have people coming here. And so, in a sense, everybody, I don't think we hugged everybody coming off the bus, but I think that we were, maybe we showed more gratitude than in some recent years, because we were so aware of how important every single person was. And also, especially if there were repeat, many people, again, as now, repeat their stays, whether they come every year, every other year, but it was almost like, welcoming relatives who you liked. Sometimes you don't like relatives. But it, back into the community, and so every time the bus arrived, it was like your family was returning, and a few new family members were joining it, but many others were already there. So it's a sort of a strange thing, I think, and Holden. I think it's a real challenge for Holden to sort of maintain that over the years, and all seasons. Some of the things that were prevalent, for those of you who were around many years ago, you remember that all the meals were family style. We had waitresses. Mm-hmm. You sat down with eight people, I guess it's eight, isn't it, at a table? And you were served, and you would eat together, you would talk together. At the end of the, there would be the prayer, everybody sang the prayer, and at the end of the meal, there was, in the evening, there was a beanie sing, and again, this, to me, was a real community activity, which, now, I'm not sure totally and exactly when it started, but I know the times I've been up here during remediation, it was very evident that you couldn't have, that type of community meal or the beanie sing or that type of community activity. But there is a difference when you are just coming in and eating and you leave. Sometimes you're there for the prayer, sometimes you're not there for the prayer. There's no beanie sing to sort of bring everybody together. Again, if you were up here during those years, it was, even with two sittings, you still, were together in that way. And at the end of the beating sing, there was always, "Let's go play volleyball," the song, that was sung after every meal. It was sort of like the doxology. And, people would leave and, the volleyball players would go down and have the game of volleyball every single night of the summer. And sometimes they got to be pretty rough volleyball games, and even that became contentious because some people felt left out because the people who really played volleyball well wanted to play by themselves, and they didn't want people who, but they, and we actually had two courts for a while, and even a new game that was invented to try to get away from the intensity of the volleyball game, and it was a game that was called Volley Bounce, and you had to let the ball bounce once before you hit it over the net again, and it didn't last too long.
I can't believe that.
It was done in a sense an attempt to be inclusive for everybody, and it was just fun. And I don't know, I mean, partially, you know, was Carol, partially was other people in the community, but also other faculty or teaching staff that were here at the time, that they would more participate in, you know, some of those activities. And again, it wasn't planned, but it just sort of happened naturally. And I guess that's the magic that happens at the right time in the you know, right part of society. But again, you know, times change, and you know, the village is much more complicated now than it used to be. And you know, maybe it's necessary to, you know, have sort of the corporate model with the more layers of management and so forth. But you know, I was thinking, well, you know, what is the difference that, you know, in 1970, 75, we had 450 people up here in the winter, I mean, in the summertime, which is basically what I think. I mean, that there's only so many that the village will handle. You can't, I mean, the bed space is limited, so, you know, they haven't added any spaces recently, I don't think. So basically, you're stuck with a maximum of, I don't know exactly, but 450 people, let's say. And we had that. Maybe not continuously in the summer, but many summer days, especially as the village became more popular, and yet it was being operated with basically, you know, very limited management and so forth. And maybe it wasn't being operated properly. Maybe, you know, we should have been more corporate. But that was just the way it was in the beginning, because that's the only way that it, in a sense, could start. And we didn't have any choice. We had, in a sense, two people and a lot of volunteers. And the volunteers were, you know, volunteers that received nothing. They received no boat fare, they received no insurance, they received no stipend. They were totally responsible for getting here. They were totally responsible if they went out for, most of them didn't go out for breaks. I mean, they were here for, you know, even 3 months. They might leave once or they may not leave at all, because they didn't have money to go down on the boat, and we didn't have any money to give them. So it was, you know, again, it was a totally different time in history and society, and also a different time for Holden. And yet somehow, you know, all the things got done. I think part of it was that you know, the people that were in charge in the various areas, whether it be the mechanic or the housekeeper or the registrar, I mean, in a sense, they were individual workers within a community, and in a sense didn't report to anybody. We were talking this morning a little bit about, you know, Fern Olson and her being a volunteer up here, and somehow, I don't think by design, but she became sort of the head housekeeper. That she didn't do the housekeeping, but she made certain that if any of the young people that were in housekeeping, that they would do it properly. And of course, at that time, all the beds were made ahead of time, just like a motel. I mean, we were the only model, I guess, that we had was sort of like a motel or hotel. And that's what we did. We had enough staff so that all the beds were made ahead of time. You didn't have to strip your bed. I mean, not that that's bad, but it was just different. And Fern was always there to sort of check the rooms once in a while, make sure that everything was done properly, everything was clean, everything was there for the guests as they arrived. And yet she wasn't really the head housekeeper. She just did that. There was a head housekeeper that worked with the volunteers. And they just did their job. You know, one thing might be that in that era, and I think all of us grew up in a different era where our parents were, they probably irritated us because they were trying to get us to learn how to pick up after ourselves and how to do a basic amount of cleaning and so forth. I'm not sure if that's the case anymore, you know. And and everybody's too busy, and everybody is, you know, you get two people working in a family, and some people even have housekeepers. But for some reason it worked there, you know, like the mechanic was totally responsible for the maintenance, and that was their kingdom up there. And if they needed help, you know, we tried to give it to them, but they knew what their responsibility was, and there was no, in a sense, corporate model of you know, working together as a corporate structure. But each, you know, of course, Wes was here for many years, and he was the king of the pool hall and bowling alleys, and it was always open. The pool hall, as I recall, was always open. The popcorn wasn't always available unless Wes was there, and Wes was finally assigned assistant after some years. But, you know, it was always open, and it was very relaxed. If Wes wanted to be down there, and he enjoyed being down there because that was where his sort of kingdom was, and that's where the young people, you know, congregated, because they loved Wes, and Wes loved them, and so, you know, they would help fix popcorn, and, you know, but nobody sort of paid much attention, it just operated. and the kitchen was the same way. I mean, that was a little bit more complicated in a sense, as it always is, because you do have a time factor, you do have a quality factor, but even that was interesting, that in the early years, Holden was a meat and potato type of operation. I mean, when we started, I don't know if they're still in existence, but Keener Meats out of Seattle was a very fine purveyor of meats, and they would make runs with their truck over, not just for Holden Village, but to Schlein, and they would, we would order, you know, beef, pork, you know, hamburger, whatever it was. I mean, we'd order, and they would flash freeze it, and they would bring it over in freezer boxes and send it up lake, and then I don't remember. I think it was in the early 70s that the price of meat escalated tremendously in all over the country, and you know, we sort of decided we can't do this anymore. And about that same time, there was more and more interest in more vegetarian activities in the society, and the considering the health value of less red meat and so forth. So those two things hit at the same time, and I think some people at Holden really thought that it was a nutritional decision to switch over, but I think about the same time it was also the cost of the meat, so it was sort of a combination. It wasn't pure thinking of our health. It was, we couldn't afford to do this anymore. So, you know, those changes take place, but the kitchen has always been a very special place, and food and meals up here has, you know, been sort of the daily communion. Again, whether it's ever practical to go back to, you know, family-style meals, I think, I assume that one reason that it's not being done is just the lack of staffing, that it's much more efficient to do the buffet lines and so forth than it is family meals. So, you know, there are factors that are involved in it. And again, it's not right or wrong. It's just the nature of the time. There are fewer volunteers that are available nowadays to come up to a place like Holden and help operate. You know, I mean, in some ways it's sad, and then in other ways you just have to say, well, that's the, you know, part of the times right now, and Holden has to adapt to it or not exist.
Yes, and an informal observer at a distance, it would seem to me that the emergence of Holden, a major player, was its relationship to the Lutheran colleges. Many, many volunteers came from there, much of the word of mouth, much of the enthusiasm. But being down for 4 or 5 years, campus changes in 4 years.
Oh, yeah.
So you can't depend on the word of mouth from the upperclassmen to the newcomers to the college
no.
to pass on the word about
right.
Holden.
No, you're right. Yeah, you're right, and that'll take a number of years to regain. And
I wonder if it doesn't require some sort of a strategy of trying to work with those colleges and getting people there purposefully to talk up Holden and to communicate. Yeah. Well, I understand that finding volunteers has become much more problematic than it was before.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, even in the early years that I would go around and Carol would go around too and visit the various colleges, you know, especially the Lutheran colleges, because that's where we had contacts. And I remember going to Augustana College in Rock Island, Illinois, and spending 4 or 5 days there, you know, doing some, you know, sharing of what Holden is all about, but also having applications there. And
I suspect that after a while that wasn't so necessary.
No, that's right. That's right.
Relationships were established and they would take care of themselves, right. But yeah. Having gone 4 or 5 years without that,
it's true, and I don't know, maybe they are doing something like that. I assume they have a you know, some type of a promotional campaign to get volunteers to come, because it, after being down for 4 or 5 years with the remediation, it's the word of mouth is not there anymore, and people that had been coming up here, you know, lost that incentive in a sense, and so I think that's one of the major things. I don't know about, like, with retired people. I mean, word of mouth is always been important to Holden, whether it's through the colleges or through the congregations, because, you know, people, if you love a place like this, then you go back and you tell, you know, your stories to others, and then all of a sudden they're wanting to come up here, and it just goes on and on and on. So it's, Holden, I think it's a real struggle. The remediation was necessary and maybe in some way financially beneficial to Holden, but it also made a big difference in terms of that continuity of information, and that needs to get back. So anybody else have a thought or idea? Yeah.
As an antidote to your comments about the corporate process, I was in the group that was negotiating with the mine company, the agencies, in 2006 and 2007 concerning the mine remediation. And we were at a meeting in Seattle sitting there, and we were commenting on the impact to this nonprofit organization. And the attorney for EPA looked at us and said, "What do you mean nonprofit? You people are not a nonprofit organization. You have a $2 million budget." And that was one of the issues that we were trying to deal with in our negotiations between the mine company, Holden Village, and the agencies themselves. So it's an issue that was there that stood out in terms of the agency people and how we were functioning.
Yeah. Well, of course, that EPA person didn't understand what nonprofit meant.
Right.
Because it's not for profit. It's that you don't pay dividends.
Yeah.
And it doesn't mean that you don't have a big budget, because there's a lot of nonprofits that have huge.
They just
budgets.
Didn't see us as being.
That's right. Yeah. It is difficult. I think with any large organization like this to see it as a nonprofit, you know, and out of necessity. But it's too bad in a sense. And I think that the church has become too corporate. You know, and. Because in order to maintain huge facilities and huge staff, you've got to raise more money, which means you have to get more people to church, which means you might have to change your preaching a little bit to not irritate some people that have money but don't like what you're saying. I mean, so that, you know, and Holden, in some ways, I remember that there was one period right before the gay lesbian issue really became one that people started to understand and accept, that there was, I think, one winter when there was sort of a dominance of the gay-lesbian issue at Holden, and it really, rather than being a positive thing, it became a negative thing, at least for some people. And fortunately, Holden, never, in a sense, gave in with what's right and what's wrong, and people changed, and, you know, I don't think that became a major problem for the village. But it's hard to not change your program, your attitude, or whatever it is, if you're trying to attract people, and you need people in order to support a place. And that, you know, that's just the nature of the operation. But it in a sense, it sort of goes back to what Carol you know, that one statement that I mentioned before, that he said that when the Holy Spirit is done with Holden, he said he hopes that Holden dies a quick death. And again, that was a hard thing for me to hear and for others to hear, but I think what, you know, Carol was right, that you know, Holden is here for something more than a Lutheran resort. Holden is here to make an impact in the church. And Holden, in a sense, has a responsibility to shake up the church a little bit and to, you know, even say, you know, you've got to rethink some of these things and have people up here that are on faculty that are willing to say that this isn't right and that the church needs to change. And, I mean, Holden, I think, has done this and continues to do it. But in the early years, in a sense, it was maybe a little bit easier. Even such things as, you remember that the Missouri Synod and the other Lutherans couldn't commune for many years. And one 4th of July, Carol took, I think Paul Hain was up here, Walt Bowman, who sort of represented the Missouri Synod at that point, and I can't remember, there was somebody else from the LCA, and it was on a 4th of July, and Carol just sort of impulsively, you know, got four or five of us, including representing each of the Lutheran synods, and he said, "We're going up behind Chalet 7 and have communion together. Nobody can stop us." And so we went up there and we had communion behind Chalet 7, and then Carol at the next Vespers or next Sunday service says, you know, from here on, everyone is welcome to participate in Holy Communion as long as you believe in Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior, you know, sort of the standard thing. But, I mean, I think maybe Holden was the first in the country that... that did that. I'm not positive, but I mean, we were early in that. And but Holden was willing to, you know, take those chances. Or even I remember Paul Hain had, in fact, he wrote a book about the corporate, you know, what it meant to be a corporation. And that was very difficult for some people up here to hear, that he says, you know, you can't expect corporations to make moral decisions. He says corporations are established to make money for stockholders. If stockholders don't require or request that, you know, there be a moral decision made, they won't do it because they have to make money for the stockholders. And, you know, a lot of people didn't like to hear that. And, you know, and so I think there, or even I remember Leo Bustead and Rudy would have sessions on the use of nuclear power in this country and almost the necessity that this needed to be done, and all nuclear power wasn't bad. And there was, you know, right at that time, there were a lot of youth especially that were, you know, wouldn't believe that. They wouldn't accept it. And science no longer was the savior of our society, but Holden was willing to have sessions that offered both sides of an issue. And this was, again, one of the, I think, the great characteristics of Carol Hinderly was that he would choose faculty and always have generally two sides of an issue discussed. And if somebody wasn't here that, you know, could oppose a particular thought, Carol would sit up in the balcony and would jump up and say, "No, that's not, you've got to consider the other side," you know, and he was the one that made sure that people in the audience didn't have to just accept, you know, one thought or one side, that there were two things you could consider and you need to discuss it. And, you know, there may not be an answer, but you can, in a civil way, you can sit around the fireplace and you can discuss this. And, you know, and that's, Holden has always been, I think, very important for that reason, that even though we're isolated and we're, you know, located in just one part of the country, one advantage now is that Holden has, you know, lectures that are streamed on the internet. So, you know, you can go on the internet and you can listen to these and hear a lot of different, you know, thoughts and so forth of theology, of society and so forth. In those days, it was primarily the people that were here, but you know, again, the whole science issue, there were the one time, in fact, it was right here in Koinonia, and the science committee, when they came up, would always give a, Leo insisted that they always give a report to the community at the end of the science and technology meeting. And Leo and Rudy Edmund were giving this report, and there were some of the staff sitting up in the balcony, and they started jeering Rudy and Leo. And, I mean, I was dumbfounded that, you know, this would actually take place. But at that point, again, the youth were saying, you know, science isn't the ultimate. But, you know, they're probably right. I mean, they wouldn't have had to jeer and made fun of the science committee. But, you know, they were right to, you know, oppose sort of what they thought was that science can answer everything, you know, that science is the ultimate. In fact, right at that time, you remember that DuPont used to have that phrase, better things through better living through chemistry. And not long after that, DuPont dropped that, not because of Holden, but I mean, it was because of society, because I think in society, it was also being accepted that science is critically important to our future, but it doesn't have all the answers, and it does make mistakes once in a while, and it does create poisons that poisons our atmosphere and our soil, and, you know, we need to keep track of science. But, I mean, those things can be discussed at a place like this, and it was with these people, and in a sense, that's what's exciting about Holden, and hopefully Holden will never lose that, you know. I mean, I hope that the corporate model, if it continues to sort of predominate, doesn't take away that opportunity for, you know, not only staff, but faculty and so forth to come here and you know, and challenge the church and challenge society, because the church needs to be challenged. And Holden is in a unique position to, you know, to be one that can challenge the church. I remember that some of the church leaders, Dr. Rognitz, who was the president of Luther Seminary in St. Paul, Minnesota, a very good friend of Carol and Murray's, and he came up numerous times and would talk about, you know, the importance of Holden and, you know, spreading the word and so forth, but it was these type of people that saw that Holden had a unique place in society and in the church. And also, I remember Dr. Rognitz mentioned to me one time, he said that, you know, when Carol lost his job with the ELCA youth department because of the merger, the church didn't quite know what to do with him, because he was a unique individual that had a very powerful message to share with the world. But, you know, where is he going to go? And so that they were delighted when Holden Village came along, and you know, Holden Village could, in a sense, be that place where Carol could use his unique abilities, and they said that they hoped that Holden Village was remote enough that there wouldn't be a cult started up here that would destroy the church, but they would keep watching it, and so. You know, that, I mean, that fear, but also I think that they felt that, you know, maybe this was a safe place. And in a sense, it became a safe place for a lot of people that were struggling at that time, not only seminary professors and preachers, but also a lot of students that just didn't know what they were going to do with their life and needed a place to come and listen to lectures, argue with professors, not worry about, you know, their own grades and their own reputations. So it's been a very special place over the years, and it needs to continue to do that. But I think that, you know, hopefully the leaders of Holden will make sure that Holden continues to challenge not only the church but society, because it's we're in a time maybe even more critical than we were in 1963. Return to some civility, to have community that we can work together, a church that can understand that you know, not only, I mean, not only do we believe in creation, but we also understand that evolution is important in the life of the world. And they're not conflicting. And up here at Holden, you can talk about those things. Whereas even some churches today, you still can't, which is unbelievable. But that's, again, why Holden needs to be a powerful voice in society and in the church. So, well, it's we've got a little time left. I don't know if any of you have any other thoughts. And
I did have thought about the hospitality. I started full-time here as a volunteer in January, but I've been here since 89 and have worked weeks for the last 15 years probably. And I did notice the difficulty getting used to a more corporate model the first month I was here. But I can see the necessity of the more corporate model after 4 years of having essentially no guests, because there's been a loss of the traditions, and so volunteers need to know what to do, and there need to be key people to tell them this is how we're going to do it. Maybe next year things will soften up and people will understand, well, we did it this way last year, maybe we can tweak it, and maybe things will eventually get a little less corporate.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I mean, I agree with you and I disagree with you, I think, because I'm not sure the corporate model necessarily has to be that, you know, the answer to that. And I'm not sure what the answer is. Again, I don't want to criticize, and I don't suppose that I have an answer, but I think I'm not sure, but I think, you know, if you start like I've always said that, you know, it's unfortunate that the Bible was written. You know, it should have been one page and three or four words, and God is love, love one another, and that should have been it. And then, you know, people started interpreting those words and coming up with their assumption of what that meant. and so we have a whole book that creates controversy because it it doesn't even agree with itself. You know, and if we just stuck with God is love, you know, love one another, we'd be okay. Well, in a sense, Holden, you know, maybe needs to, you know, sort of get back in that sense of, you know, we're here to love everybody that comes, and we're one community. We're not a separate community. You know, we're not faculty. We're teaching staff. We're not volunteers. We're not paid workers. But we're one big happy family. But you're right. I mean, there's got to be direction. But can that happen naturally, or does it have to happen, you know, with a corporate model? I think the corporate model is what we're used to, but I still have problems, you know, I guess, thinking that for the church and for Holden that the corporate model is what needs to be, you know, there. I mean, even for the churches, I think, is it necessary that churches constantly... I mean, I think one of the problems, and I don't think anybody agrees with me, but the great missionary command, go and make all, I can't remember what the command is anymore, but it says something about going and making all people Christian. and I think that's unfortunate. You know, I think it should have been something that we should go and love one another and help the world, you know, be filled with love. And, you know, Holden needs to, you know, in a sense, be the same thing, that let's, you know, be at the bus and let's welcome every single person on that bus and walk them around the village and take them to the snack bar and you know, let them know that they're a part of this community. And, you know, and maybe it still does. And again, I haven't had a lot of experience, but, you know, we very frequently had people coming up to us that were going to be here for a week and say, can we join the staff just for this week. I mean, we're paying, but we'd like to help out. What can we do? You know, and you know, that was a great sort of model for the village to have. You know, it's again, it's almost a fear of having a Lutheran resort or a Christian community. And I think that's the struggle. And again, going back to Goldberg and Carol Hinderly, I think that was the struggle then, and it will always continue to be the struggle. And you know, maybe there's no clear answer, but I think the struggle, the people that are here need to really constantly struggle with that. And if the corporate model is necessary for the next 2 years, you know, then can it be changed after that? Or another thing is that even, you know, like the bookstore was started originally because the faculty coming here said, I'm going to use such and such a book for my lecture. Could you have copies available in case anybody wants to buy it? Because we didn't have a bookstore originally. So that's really what started the bookstore. And then, you know, once that happened, then it became evident that, you know, people coming up here, and especially the lay people, they came up here and maybe for a week would want to read a book that they would not be able to do in their normal life. And so the bookstore gradually expanded into a, you know, really a wonderful, wonderful bookstore. But it was almost out of demand for the people. And even though Amazon is very handy, and I admit that I order a lot of books from Amazon, that when people come here, they're isolated, and you can't, I mean, you can order stuff, I suppose, through Amazon, but you can't get it in the 2 days that they claim you can get it. But I mean, so, you know, should the bookstore ever disappear from Holden, even though Amazon is available, because you're dealing with people who come here for a personal retreat or a family retreat, and it's maybe the only time that they have available to read a theological book or a book of social issues and so forth. And, you know, if anything, you know, the bookstore should be expanded because, you know, I mean, reading is still a very important part of our life. And so anyway, that, you know, I mean, all those little things, I think, at Holden have to be seriously considered, and not just because, you know, we're short on staff, or it's more efficient to do it this way, or most people order their books on Amazon, so why should we expand the bookstore here? I don't think those are all the wrong questions that should be asked up here. You know, it's how can we get more people to read? Yes?
Yeah, I'm a little disappointed that, to me, the bookstore this time was not as good as it has been in years past. And when I was in my 30s and 40s, the bookstore up here was a real haven because I didn't know about these books, so it's hard to order something you don't even know about. So both social issues and Thomas Burton, I was introduced to Thomas Burton up here. And so it's actually meager to me to look at the bookstore as compared to years ago. And the only thing that compares to Holden's bookstore in my mind is the Episcopal Church in the Queen Anne district of Seattle had a pretty good bookstore, and this was quite a long time ago. But I feel that I can't go to the bookstore that's called the Christian bookstore, that's family something or other, that seems to be a big chain. It's not what Holden's bookstore is.
Yeah, yeah.
So I understand that the bookstore is struggling right now, but don't ever, if anybody's here on the board, don't ever let go of the bookstore and strengthen it.
Yeah, and that's one, in a sense, you know, one aspect of Holden. But all aspects of Holden, there should almost be, if we're going to use a corporate model, then there should be an executive to research Holden on a daily basis, how it can better, you know, be involved in the church and the world, you know, and because I think, you know, maybe the efficiency isn't the main thing for Holden. You know, maybe we've got to get back and say inefficiency can be, you know, at times better than efficiency. And so maybe family meals need to be returned rather than something that's more efficient. And again, I don't want to sound negative, but I think Holden is a community, a family place, and you know, whoever has the privilege of being involved in the operation of Holden needs to constantly think how it can be a greater community and a greater challenge to the church and society, and then design Holden to make sure it is that, and not just based on efficiency or you know, lack of staff or, you know, whatever it is. I mean, efficiency has its place, but I'm not sure efficiency has its place at Holden. So, just a second.
In terms of the family meal, I was here when Carol Hinderly's son, Paul Hinderly, served his first New Year's Day dinner. It was a sit-down dinner. We did have a served meal. It was prime rib with roasted roots. It was an incredible meal. And during Paul's tenure here, we regularly had sit-down dinners where you had to wait outside for your turn to get to a table. So it didn't totally disappear. But the bookstore issue, I think, has been severely impacted by the 4 years where we lost the hotel. The mine company took total control of the hotel, and I think it had a serious impact.
Those things are understandable. It's just that, you know, can now, you know, Holden rethink itself and you know, like the meals too. Some of those special meals started in the wintertime because we were together as a community, and so over the winter, for many years, that maybe once a month there would be, you know, the kitchen would do a French motif, and so everybody would dress up in their finest, and it was the only time anybody put on a suit or sometimes a dress or pardon?
From potty patrol.
Yeah,
you
right.
You go scrounge things to
put. Right, yeah, yeah, yeah. And, you know, and then there was the early 50s night when, you know, there was Bobby Socks, and so those things. I mean, the kitchen has been such an important part of Holden, and, you know, Paul and many other people who were here, you know, created these play times. And play times at Holden has been very important. And I don't know if any of you remember the series on television, Northern Exposure. Yeah, and because, I mean, when I saw Northern Exposure, and that was in the 1990s, I loved it. I got the full set of DVDs. Because it reminded me so much about Holden, because the little Alaskan town, which happened to be Roslyn, Washington, I mean, they were always creating artificial celebrations, or they would celebrate something that had no meaning except for that little community. And even the spirituality was very strange, but there, you know, it was a Native American spirituality, and the person that was sort of the local pastor was also the DJ, and you know, so it really reminded me to a great extent of Holden, and you know, just the fun of make believe and all the things that we did up here, from the 4th of July parades to, you know, like Christmas in July was another one that has been going on. I think they still celebrate it, but the way it was started was that Reuben Thompson, who was the original caretaker up here for 2 winters, was here all by himself. And so that the staff, you know, said, well, we need to, I mean, Reuben was here without family for Christmas. And so they said, okay, on July 24th, we'll have a Christmas celebration for Reuben so that he can be a part of the family celebration. So it became, you know, and after that then, the Christmas in July in some of the early years was the most populated time up here. I mean, the village was completely full because it was so unique. And one time, and Wes would get in his Santa suit, And he would go down to the boat on for that time on July 24th and would stand at the dock welcoming the people off the boat in his Santa suit. And Hugh Blanc, who was a rather famous journalist for the Wenatchee World, he'd been involved in many of the writings for the Grand Coulee Dam and so forth. He was retired, but he did some articles. And he was coming up lake with some friends of his in a private boat, and he saw Wes Creeb in his Santa suit and these people getting off, and he said, "There's a story here someplace. I've got to go up to Holden." So he told the people that he was coming up late. He said, "I want to get off here, and I'll just take the regular boat back." And so he came up and he interviewed me, and he said, "You know, what's going on here?" So I explained to him about Christmas in July, and he talked to other people and so forth. And he went back and wrote an article for the Wenatchee World. Well, it was picked up by UPI, and this article went all over the country about this little mountain town that was celebrating 4th of July. And I remember, and I think September of that year, that I got a letter from a faculty from Pennsylvania who was driving the turnpike. And he said, all of a sudden they started playing Christmas music, and then they had this story about this little village in the Cascade Mountains that celebrated Christmas in July. And we got articles from all over the country from people that, you know, their home papers, they saw it in their home papers, and they would cut it out and send it to us. And I don't know if some of those, I think, are probably available for the museum, but it was one of those unique things where, in a sense, having Christmas for Reuben, you know, created a celebration that still exists, and it went all over the country. And probably, I mean, I've heard recently that there are other places now that are celebrating Christmas in July. Now, that may not have anything to do with, probably it has more to do with commercialism than Holden Village.
Yeah.
But those are the unique things that happen in a community when, you know, just sort of things happen. And it was the staff, some of the volunteers, that wanted to have Christmas because they loved Reuben Thompson and they were sorry that he had to be here all by himself. And so, you know, to me, those are the things that make Holden, you know, what Holden is and hopefully will always be. But I think it is a struggle. And just like, you know, life is a struggle, and we have to keep making sure. And I think we as individuals that love Holden also have an opportunity to make sure that you know, we tell the Holden people, the board and others, that, you know, we may not have the answers, but we want Holden to be a challenge to the church and society, and we want Holden to provide a situation for where we understand that God is love and we love one another, and even if we don't read the Bible, we can at least do that. So I guess
Fourth of July at Holden is an incredible event for the fireworks.
It is.
Because they show the movie of the fireworks Washington, D.C.
Oh, yeah.
But the village saves all of the plastic shipping bags, and everybody has several plastic shipping bags to smash with their foot, and the fireworks in VC is incredible.
Oh, yeah. Lights. Well, I mean, one other just little story that it was interesting, you know, when we did try to have television up here, and I bought a little portable 12-volt television set one time, and we carried a battery and an antenna all over the place, including the upper mine level, and trying to find where we might get a signal. And we did find a signal that was apparently coming off of the snowfields and the glaciers at Bonanza. It was bouncing from Channel 6 out of Spokane. And we kept that. And we actually had it in our chalet when we lived here. And it was, you know, you couldn't hardly watch it, but it was there. You could hear it more than watch it. But we did have a TV in the dining room one time, and it just happened, or we set it up specifically, because when Nixon gave his resignation speech, you know, it was a rather big thing, and we did keep up with the news. And so we had that TV in the dining room, and it was enough so that we could at least hear Nixon give his resignation speech. And, you know, so Holden, you know, is definitely a part of the world, but it sometimes struggles because it's hard to get news up here. But, you know, whether it's the 4th of July, and that was, you know, the 4th of July when we started that many years ago, the parade and so forth, it was sort of tongue-in-cheek. It was sort of wanting to be a part of a national celebration and yet, you know, wanting to sort of make fun of, you know, of celebrations in the country, because there was, you know, in those years, again, it was the hippie generation that was creating a lot of new thought, and not all of it was, you know, positive towards the church or towards society, but Holden, you know, was a place where we could make fun of one another and give thanks for one another and I think make the church and the world a better place. So hopefully that'll continue. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.